Good evening and welcome back. Today is Friday, March 4th. I'm Dylan Law.
And I'm Alice Tennant. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia, to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
It is 5.05 p.m. and time for a full hour of independent campus, local, and international news.
Up first, we have News 101 co-director Emily Blake's interview with Sean Hosein from CATIE, Canadian AIDS Treatment Information Exchange. He discusses Health Canada's approval of Trevado for HIV prevention, PrEP, and HIV in Canada.
Following that, we have News 101 co-director Rohit Joseph's interview with...
We also have News 101 correspondent Kelly Rayburn's report on the BC Liberals and their implementation of a monthly bus rate for people with disabilities.
To finish off the show, we have News 101 co-director Emily Blake's interview with UBC faculty member Juliet O'Brien. She discusses the Paula Butler report, the GSS sexual assault report, and speaking out as a faculty member.
But first, some headlines for today. In campus news, UBC announces new sexual assault committee. The university has created a new committee to develop a standalone sexual assault policy. The panel of 12 is made up of students, staff, and faculty members. It will be led by Vice President of Equality and Inclusion, Sarah Jane Finley, and Kimberly Beck from the Office of the Universal Council. The first draft of the new policy will be completed in June, and the final policy will be submitted to the Board of Governors in October. UBC has also announced a separate panel of four professors and a graduate student who will prepare recommendations for the policy committee by May. The university is also working on a campus-wide prevention plan and an action plan to improve campus culture, policy, and practice.
In local news, protesters forced to leave Site C Dam. The BC Supreme Court has granted BC Hydro an injunction to remove protesters from its Site C Dam near Fort St. John. Protesters have obeyed the order by dismantling the camp and leaving the area. Local farmer Arlene Boom, who has been camping at the protest site for 32 days, said, quote, "At this time, none of us are going to be arrested because we are law-abiding citizens." Those who oppose the dam say it will flood agricultural land, First Nations archaeological sites, and hunting and fishing areas. Yvonne Tupper, a land occupier with the Treaty 8 Tribal Association, said, quote, "We bought a small chunk of land, another 62 days of life. When you understand your relationship to the land, it tells you where your place is." The camp has been blocking an area set up as a dumping site for waste rock since December. BC Hydro argued the protest camp was costing millions of dollars in delays. BC Hydro Jessica McDonald said, quote, "The most important thing is to be able to work safely for everyone's concern and to be able to move forward and keep project on time and on budget."
Squamish Music Festival cancelled. The Squamish Valley Music Festival, scheduled to take place in August, has been cancelled for 2016. The festival website states, quote, "We sincerely apologize to all the people this decision affects, the fans, artists, industry partners, corporate partners, suppliers, and all of our supporters within the community of Squamish." The festival's Twitter and Instagram accounts have also been deleted, leading to speculation the festival will be cancelled permanently. Squamish Mayor Patricia Heintzman said the district is disappointed with the decision, stating, quote, "Squamish Fest has helped our town transition to a place that has been recognized on best of a list publications. It has become part of the tapestry of our town." Last year, 115,000 people attended the festival.
In national news, Health Canada approves drug for HIV prevention. Health Canada has approved Truvada to reduce the risk of sexual transmission of the virus. Truvada is a pill that contains two anti-HIV drugs. The company's chief executive, Norbert Bischofberger, said, quote, "We are pleased to offer this important HIV prevention tool to at-risk populations in Canada." Truvada is part of a combination therapy for people with HIV and may also be prescribed as prevention for HIV-negative people. Taking medicines to reduce the risk of infection is called pre-exposure prophylaxis, or PrEP. Truvada reduces HIV transmission rates by more than 90%. Health Canada approved Truvada along with its testing before starting the drug, screening for STIs, regular and frequent HIV testing, and the use of condoms. Sean Hosein, of Katie, said, quote, "Now our insurance companies, our provinces and territories need to get on board with an HIV prevention strategy that includes Truvada. But the medication is costly at around $1,000 per month." Also this week, a man taking Truvada contracted HIV, making him the first person regularly taking the drug to be infected. The HIV health site said, the HIV health site PAWS reported that he has contracted a rare drug-resistant strain of the virus. HIV researcher Richard Harrigan says, "I certainly don't think that this is a situation which calls for panic. It is an example that demonstrated that PrEP can sometimes be ineffective in the face of drug-resistant virus, in the same way that treatment itself can sometimes be ineffective in the face of drug-resistant virus."
Manitoba Liberal candidate resigns over misogynist tweets. Less than 24 hours after his nomination, the NDP demanded the resignation of Jamie Hall. This was after they discovered multiple tweets by Hall where he used derogatory terms to refer to women. Hall apologized, but has also called his comments humorous and satirical. Liberal leader Rana Bokhari responded by saying, quote, "The comments were disgusting. There's not who we are. This is not who we are as a party. That's not who I am as a person. As a woman, you can imagine I feel sick to the stomach right now, even just standing here." Hall has also been criticized for the novel he wrote in 2011 titled Seven Deadly Women, his former dating blog, and for posting sexualized videos of female bartenders as a bar promoter. Hall has continued to defend himself, saying, quote, "I have countless friends that are women, my girlfriend, my mother, my sister, my grandmas, who no longer with me, and I am not by any means sexist." Hall noted that NDP candidate Wab Kanu has also been criticized for using misogynist language during his career as a rapper. Kanu apologized for his lyrics at a music award ceremony and his 2015 book titled The Reason You Walk. Kanu wrote, quote, "At a time where I thought it was funny, what had shock value, with the epidemic of violence against women and Indigenous women in particular, there is no excuse for this."
In international news, UN approves sanction on North Korea. The UN Security Council unanimously has approved the toughest sanctions on the country in the last 20 years. These include a mandatory cargo inspections, a ban on imports of aviation fuel, and limits on exports of coal, iron, gold, and titanium. This in response to the regime's recent nuclear and ballistic missile tests, which defy current sanctions. President Obama said of the decision, quote, "The international community, speaking with one voice, has sent Pyongyang a simple message. North Korea must abandon these dangerous programs and choose a better path for its people." The sanctions were approved after 7 weeks of negotiations between the United States and China. Secretary of State John F. Kerry said the goal is to, quote, "hold the regime to the account for its increasingly provocative behavior." The resolution also terminates North Korea's banking relationships with outside institutions and prevents North Koreans from teaching abroad in certain fields, including advanced physics and aerospace engineering. It also bans the state from using ballistic missile technology and freezes the overseas assets of 16 people and 12 government agencies. In response to the sanctions, North Korea launched a few short-range missiles on Thursday morning, according to South Korea's defense ministry. This is not the first time the Security Council has approved resolutions targeted at North Korea's nuclear and missile programs in the last decade, but past enforcement has been poor.
Those are your campus, local, national, and international headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more contributor segments.
How much do you know about bikes? Everything? Perfect. Nothing at all? Even better. At the UBC Bike Kitchen, you can use our space and tools to do your own bike maintenance, get one-on-one instruction on how to fix your bike yourself, or drop your bike off for us to repair. You can also buy a fully refurbished, guaranteed used bicycle, or a variety of new and used parts and accessories. The Bike Kitchen is UBC's non-profit, student-owned, full-service bike shop. We're located in the basement of the Student Union Building. Just look for the stairwell on the north side of the sub across from Gage Towers, or search for the UBC Bike Kitchen on Facebook. Stop by the Bike Kitchen and then get riding.
Right.
intrigued, be amazed, be inspired. Attend a 3-minute thesis competition and experience the purpose and passion of some of UBC's finest graduate student researchers. Attending is free and awesome. Come out to the semis on March 8th from 1 to 4:30 and the finals on March 10th from 4:30 to 6 in the Graduate Student Center Ballroom. Listen, learn, and leave feeling smarter. Check out 3mt.grad.ubc.ca for more information.
My name is David Scott. I play wide receiver for the University of British Columbia football team, and I'm here to discuss the Be More Than a Bystander program. Myself and a few other players were lucky enough to work alongside the BC Lions and EVA, the Ending Violence Association, to support this cause. The main goal of the Be More Than a Bystander initiative is to increase awareness of domestic violence against women. For more information on the cause, please visit endingviolence.org.
Welcome back to News 101. You are listening to us live on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the UBC in Vancouver, BC. Thank you for being with us.
We have Emily Blake's interview with Sean Hosine from KT about Trivader, PrEP, and HIV in Canada. We want to let our listeners know that the following interview contains discussion on sex and sexual health.
Health Canada has approved Truvada as a preventative therapy for HIV. This is part of pre-exposure prophylaxis, or PrEP, which is taking medicine to reduce the risk of infection. I spoke with Sean Hosine, the science and medicine editor with Katie, to learn more about PrEP, Truvada, and HIV in Canada. So Health Canada just approved Truvada. It's also part of PrEP. I was wondering if you could explain for maybe people who don't understand, what is this?
Okay, so Truvada is the brand name of two anti-HIV medicines in one pill, tenofovir and another drug called emtricitabine. It's taken one pill, taken once daily with or without food. Health Canada approved this as part of a package of reducing the risk of getting HIV through sex. So this is called pre-exposure prophylaxis, or PrEP. And Truvada must be used as part of a package of prevention tools, and this includes testing for HIV and other sexually transmitted infections before you start taking Truvada, because you want to make sure we don't give it to people who have HIV, because it's not enough to treat HIV and get the STIs treated. And it's meant to be used together with condoms, because Truvada by itself is not 100% protective. And at least every 3 months while somebody's taking Truvada, they've got to get tested for HIV to make sure there are no breakthrough infections. So in the gold standard of clinical trials called randomized clinical trials, that's the type of clinical trials where you compare it to placebo or another intervention. In these cases, over the past 5 years, it's found to be highly effective, and the effectiveness increases in people who take it on a regular basis. And this is a very new thing. This is the first time in history that we have a product, a drug, that can help reduce the risk of getting HIV. So it's a very important thing, because HIV is still happening in Canada. I think the last year for which we have statistics is 2014. And, you know, there were about 2,500 new cases of HIV in that year. And I think if some of them had used Truvada as part of a prevention strategy, maybe those infections wouldn't have occurred.
And so I read that an issue that's still remaining is the cost or the insurance coverage for this type of drug.
So in the short term, I think cost is an issue. It is an expensive drug. It costs about $1,000 per month. And so the first step is that insurance companies must start listing Truvada as PrEP as a drug that they are prepared to reimburse patients who have private insurance. Now, many people in Canada do not have private insurance. And this is where I think there's a role for our provinces and territories to play. And they need to consider what part of their HIV prevention strategy does Truvada fit. Because, you know, every province has slightly different drivers of infection, HIV infections, And, you know, Truvada can play a role. Where can it play a role? Where can it be deployed to have the maximum benefit? And it's going to be different in every province. So they've got to look at that. And then once that's figured out, and it shouldn't take too long, provinces then need to think about, okay, maybe we should add it to our list of medicines that we subsidize for people, because yes, it does cost a lot, but you know what? In almost every case with major diseases, it's a lot cheaper to prevent something than waiting until it's happened and then having to treat it later. The lifetime costs of treating HIV are very high, and I don't just mean the medicines. There are doctor's visits, laboratory testing, some hospital visits, and so on for some people. Truvada will not be used by everybody. Not everybody likes taking a pill. Furthermore, people will not be taking Truvada forever. They'll be doing it through seasons of risk. Now, a season of risk for some people might be 6 months to a year. For other people, a couple years. For other people, 3 years. But it's only for high-risk people. It's not for everybody at risk for HIV, just highest risk. And if in counseling their patients, doctors and patients agree who's at the highest risk and deploy it that way, it's a lot less than giving it to everybody.
So you say high-risk groups will be the ones largely taking this medication. Who falls under those groups?
So, you know, it's for people where exposure to HIV might be very high through sexual activity, intercourse. So that might be some men who have sex with men. That might be heterosexual couples where one partner has HIV and the other does not. It might also include people who are engaged in substance use, who might have sex with someone who's in their sexual network who might have HIV. Those are just some of the cases. So it has applicability.
Are there any potential risks or concerns with taking this medication?
Yes. As with every and any medication, there's always the possibility of side effects. So in the short term, there can be things like headache, nausea, diarrhea. Usually these are very mild, and they pass after the first few days or first week in most cases. And then in the long term, there are some rare side effects, such as a decrease in the effectiveness of the kidneys and perhaps some thinness to bones. But this doesn't happen in everyone. But it's still important for people using Truvada that they have to visit their doctors on a regular basis, like at least every 3 months. So the doctor can do blood tests to check for some of these, and if necessary, some more sophisticated testing for bone density and stuff like that. So, yeah, it is not without the potential side effect.
So I did read about this case very recently in Toronto, where it was the first person who was regularly taking Truvada who actually became HIV positive, infected while they were taking it.
That's a really good point. I'm so glad you raised that, because this is something important. We've always said to people before, you know, you've got to use this as part of a package of tools, including regular testing and condoms, to help reduce your risk of HIV. Truvada by itself is not 100% effective. And this case is very clear, and it underscores the fact that Truvada is not 100% effective. In randomized clinical trials, Truvada was never 100% effective, and people need to know this. However, it was more effective than placebo, and it's even more effective when it's taken every day as directed and used as part of a package of prevention activities that are mentioned. Now, in this particular case, the man in question was following his doctor's instructions. He was taking it every day. He was getting tested regularly, and unfortunately, because he wasn't always using condoms when he had sex, he got exposed to HIV and became infected. And this, you know, it's deeply unfortunate that this happened, and it's sad, but it also confirms what even the company says in the prescribing information, and that is people have been infected while taking Truvada. So it's really important to use condoms.
From what I heard, the strand of HIV that he contracted is a rare type that happens to be resistant to these types of drugs.
You raised two good points. It was rare in that it broke through quite a number of drugs, not only the Truvada medications. it was resistant to quite a few other HIV medicines that this man had never taken. And the man was inadvertently infected by someone else who was infected with the strain. It's very rare, true, but people are exposed to things that are in their sexual networks, and some sexual networks vary in size. For instance, a sexual network might be a monogamous couple. A sexual network might include people that occasionally have threesomes or foursomes. But a sexual network can be even larger if you're having a lot of partners, some of whom are anonymous. And one concern is the possibility that as more people who take Truvada do so without the protection, the added protection of condoms, there may be more cases of infection. And we don't know who the source of this infection was because he was an anonymous partner. But this is a signal that some sexual network somewhere have someone who has a form of HIV that can cut right through Truvada. You know, I talked to the doctor who looks after this patient. He's a really nice guy. And the doctor said, you know, people come to him and ask for Truvada because they do not want to get HIV. And the best way not to get HIV is to take your Truvada every day exactly as directed and use condoms as often as possible whenever you have sex.
And as a child of the 90s, I think a lot of people my age and younger tend not to think of HIV as much of a risk anymore, that it's kind of an issue that's already
far
been
away.
Dealt with. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, thank you for your honesty. That's it's really good to raise that, because if you look in the media today, apart from the Truvada story, most stories in the media concerning AIDS or HIV usually talk about it in the context of a sub-Saharan African issue. And so people think HIV is not in Canada anymore because you hardly hear about it. You hardly see anybody who looks like they're dying from AIDS anymore because we have medicines that can keep it under control and, if taken exactly as directed, can help people live a near normal lifespan. So you don't see people dying in front of you of untreated HIV or AIDS, much like you used to do before 1996. So you think, oh yeah, HIV is a faraway problem, but HIV is here, and it's concentrated in certain populations. For instance, in downtown Toronto, researchers estimate that about 19 to 20% of gay men have HIV. And estimates for the concentration of HIV are also high in certain parts of downtown Vancouver, downtown Ottawa, downtown Montreal, and so on. This is not to say that there aren't people with HIV outside of those places in Canada, but I always try to get people to think back to their sexual network where that's happening. Somebody wrote on our agency's Facebook page that they wrote something like, you know, Truvada is an important evolution. I'm paraphrasing them. They said, you know, we've tried to reduce accidents on the road by doing a number of things like reducing the speed limit, discouraging drinking and driving, encouraging people to use seatbelts, the invention of the airbag. All of these things over time add one layer of protection after another. And that's what Truvada and condoms do. They're layers of protection to keep you from getting this virus, which can do a lot of harm.
I know Katie did a lot of work in promoting the use of PrEP. Could you talk to me about their involvement in Health Canada's approval of Truvada?
So Katie has done a lot to help educate people about how to use PrEP correctly, how to talk to their doctors about it, about the limits of PrEP, and the best way to use PrEP to reduce their risk. We did not lobby Health Canada. A lot of people are saying, oh, it's all Health Canada's fault that we only have Truvada now in 2016, when the first country to approve it was the United States in 2012. But Health Canada can't go out and ask any drug company, oh, come, we want to approve your drug, come here and do that. That would be lobbying, and that would be unethical. Health Canada has rules and restrictions, as does the FDA in the United States and the agency in Europe as well. And so the drug company has to be ready to submit a dossier of data on a drug to be approved. And the drug company didn't submit that dossier until almost the fall of 2015. That's not a long time ago. And Health Canada moved fairly quickly in approving it. So it's not Health Canada's fault that we haven't had Truvada approved since it was approved in America. And in fact, there are only a handful of countries that approved it. It was the United States, Kenya, South Africa, Canada, and then I think Israel.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time to talk with me.
Oh, you're welcome, Emily. It was fun, and we'd like to let your readers know that if they've got more interest in finding out about Truvada and Safer Sex, to please visit our website. That's CATIE.ca.
Thank you, Emily. Now we have Rohit Joseph's interview with Joe Weeb, co-founder of the upcoming craft beer festival, Victoria Beer Week.
Why don't we just let you introduce yourself so that way I can test the levels here.
Sure. My name is Joe Weeb. I'm the author of Craft Beer Revolution, The Insider's Guide to BC Breweries, and I'm a co-founder of Victoria Beer Week, going into our third year now, March 4 to 12.
First things first, can you give a little bit of history as to how Victoria Beer Week came together?
Sure, no problem. Basically, I moved over from Vancouver, actually, to Victoria in 2012. I'd lived here in Victoria in the 90s as well, but I was in Vancouver for 12 years in between. And I moved over here, and I was working on my book, the first edition of my book, and then when that came out, I started thinking that it would be really cool to set up a beer week similar to what they had in Vancouver already. Vancouver Craft Beer Week had been going already for a couple of years, and I'd heard of other similar things in Seattle and so on, Portland, and places like that. And I started talking about it to some of the people I knew in the beer community here, and a couple of the major players, I guess you'd call them, said, oh, well, there's another group talking about Victoria Beer Week as well. So they hooked me up with those guys, and basically it was some of the, like the president of the local Camera group. Camera is the campaign for real ale. And then there was a few different people that worked in the beer industry in various roles. And so we kind of all linked up and started talking about how we thought it would work best and basically put together the first week 2 years ago in 2014. And then it was much more successful, to be honest, than we even hoped. We worked really hard to bump it up a notch and felt like we were successful in that. And now this year, we're continuing to try to grow it. And the way things have developed, I've taken on a bigger and bigger role as kind of general administrator, kind of co-producer for the festival, along with one or two other people who are kind of playing big roles as well.
That's awesome, Joe. So for those of us who are, you know, relatively new to the whole craft beer scene, we keep hearing that it's growing and growing. So can you put things in the context for us and say, when did this growth really start to happen in BC in general for the craft beer scene?
For sure. Just a quick overview. Basically, craft beer started here in 1982 when the Horseshoe Bay Brewery opened. And then in 1984, it kind of had its second start, so to speak, when Spinnaker's Brew Pub opened here in Victoria and Granville Island Brewing opened in Vancouver and also Vancouver Island Brewery opened over here. And then from then on, it's been kind of gradual and you know, consistent growth with little peaks and valleys here and there. But to be honest, what really the big explosion that's happened in recent years started in 2012. And since then, we've just seen incredible growth. In early 2013, we had reached about 50 breweries. My book came out in early 2013 with 50 breweries listed in it. And since then, we've more than doubled in size. Right now, by my count, we're at 103. So basically, the last 2 years I've seen 21 new breweries open each year. And it's just continuing. We expect that many to open again this year, so it's just continuing to boom. Vancouver specifically has had a really significant boom in recent years after a long kind of fallow period when nothing was seemed to be happening in terms of new operations, at least. But otherwise, yeah, around the province, we're seeing consistent growth and lots of development in all over BC.
Is there any particular reason that you know of for the growth happening so quickly within just these past like 2-3 years?
Well, I think it's a combination of a few different factors that kind of created a sort of critical mass that allowed this kind of recent explosion to occur. I mean, I mentioned that Vancouver hadn't had anything new for a long time. 1998 to 2012, nothing new opened there. But things were still happening in Vancouver that were kind of building up this sense of potential there. Like, we had the arrival of sort of the tap house culture with places like the Alibi Room and and St. Augustine's, and of course a lot of other places since then. And then we also had this kind of buildup of interest in craft beer through the private liquor stores that started bringing in lots of different and interesting and exciting beers from, you know, Portland and California, and even things from Belgium and Germany that were really new and exciting, at least new and exciting to us here. And that created a kind of a culture where people were getting more and more interested and more excited about that stuff. And also among the breweries, you know, you talk to some of the brewers, they sort of felt challenged, you know, by this amazing beer that was showing up from places like Portland and California. And they were, you know, it kind of raised the bar for them as well, you know. So those are, to me, the kind of the two big factors that really contributed to building up this potential. And then in a lot of ways, it was about the floodgates opening. When breweries opened in 2012 and 2013 in Vancouver, like Parallel 49 opened in 2012, and then 33 Acres. That really started encouraging people and encouraging other potential breweries to, you know, to speed up their game. And it just became this like this flood, basically. And since Vancouver is the biggest population center and the biggest you know, kind of revenue engine in BC, that has really pushed the whole industry all across the province. So you see, you know, you see all the new breweries opening in the suburbs around Vancouver, but you also see new breweries here on Vancouver Island and the Okanagan and the Kootenays up north. So it's just really fueled the fire, so to speak, and created a big, big explosion.
Yeah, because I noticed when I was just counting up, because you'd given me a list of these breweries, and I saw that like about 20 of 27 Vancouver breweries opened up within 2012 to 2015. So that was a ridiculous, ridiculous number.
Amazing. This whole like brewery neighborhood, there's like two distinct brewery neighborhoods in Vancouver now, like along Main Street, what I call the Brewery Creek area, and then, you know, East Van over east of Clark Drive over to all the way over to, you know, Commercial and Victoria. And basically those two neighborhoods didn't even really exist in 2012. I mean, Storm Brewing was over there by Commercial, but before Parallel 49 opened over there, there was, you know, that was the only place over there. So yeah, it's amazing how this incredible culture that's just so vibrant right now and just really exciting, you know, is really brand new too.
Going back to Victoria Beer Week, there's all these brand new breweries that have opened up just within the last year or so. Are you guys trying to focus in on some of these breweries? And if so, are you unveiling some of their, you know, the latest beers?
We're doing our best to bring in as many of the newly recently opened breweries as we can. Of course, some of them, you know, aren't able to come right away. Like if they've opened just in the fall or something, it might be too soon for them to trek over here. If they're from the mainland, for instance, just because, you know, there's two foot, like a place like, but yeah, we actually have quite a few of the new breweries from the last couple of years coming here from either from up island or from over on the mainland. And we also, yeah, we're doing a special event that is an opportunity for people to taste 12 brand new beers that will not have existed before that day.
Oh, wow.
Which is called Liftoff, and that's happening on Saturday, March 12th, that's basically the closing event for Victoria Beer Week. And it's held in a historic venue here in Victoria called Market Square, and it's an outdoor venue, so we'll have tents and so on if the weather's bad, but it's a really cool space. And yeah, 12 different breweries, some local here, some from the mainland. We even have a couple from the Okanagan and one coming all the way out from Nelson. So, and they're all launching a brand new beer on that day. So
can you give us a few examples?
Yeah, for sure. Well, there's the one coming out from Nelson is called Torchlight Brewing. Yeah, so Torchlight is bringing out something called 1181 Imperial Stout. So 1181 is a reference to, I think, to the Lord of the Rings.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, 1181 is, you know, 111, basically. And so that's a reference to the original gravity of the beer, which if anybody knows has any knowledge of brewing, means basically the quantity of the malts and sugars in the beer that get converted into alcohol. So something with that high of a starting specific gravity is going to be a very strong beer. And they say it will be a 10% alcohol in that one. So that should be a good one. Another good example of a beer being launched at that event is from local brewery here, Swan's Brew Pub. They're doing a beer called Sucker Punch, which is a dry hop sour beer. And over from the mainland there, Yellow Dog Brewing is launching a new beer called Go Fetch. Most of their beers have all their beers have some sort of dog reference in the title, which makes sense. So Go Fetch is a West Coast hoppy saison. Yeah, so, and there's a few others. We're still kind of keeping some of them under wraps just to keep the mystery around.
That's cool.
Yeah.
One of the cool events that I saw was an International Women's Day event that features some of the female brewmasters. Can you tell us a little bit about what's the celebration there? Like, I know it's beer and International Women's Day, but how are they related?
Yeah, for sure. That's an event called Drink in the Story, which is an event we started last year. And the idea to it is that we have three brewers talking about their, you know, some story about their career, their brewery, how they, you know, how they became a brewer, that sort of thing. And then in conjunction with that, one of their beers is served along with a special food item at the venue. It's called the Drake. And this year, the focus is going to be all on women brewers because it's happening on International Women's Day, Tuesday, March 8th. So we have three women involved in the brewing industry in BC. We have Julia Hanlon, who is the brewmaster at Steamworks Brewing. She just took over last summer from the previous one, and she moved to Steamworks from Molson. So she actually has, I hope, a really interesting story about that transition since she moved from a big brewery to a craft brewery. And then we have Chloe Smith from Townsite Brewing up in Powell River. Now, she's not the brewmaster there. Her husband is, but she is a trained brewer, and she and her husband, who's a Belgian guy named Cedric, had met in Montreal and then tried to open a brew pub themselves in Saskatoon, where she's from, and then ended up in Powell River. And so, but she runs the brewery. She's the general manager at the brewery. So basically, you know, she's going to have a really interesting take on things, I'm sure, as well. And then the other one is Karen Cusick from Category 12 Brewing here in Victoria. And she's also not the brewmaster. Her husband is there, but she's basically running the brewery as well and has a good story because she used to be more of a wine lover than a beer lover. So she's, I think, going to have a really interesting angle on what kind of brought her to beer, which was probably all the home brewing that her husband was doing.
Awesome. Thank you, Joe.
Yeah.
To kind of close things off, I guess, like, for this year's Victoria Beer Week, what really separates it from other, you know, craft beer festivals? Since now there's so many going on, what would you tell people separates Victoria Beer Week from all the rest of the beer weeks?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I think what the way we looked at it when we were starting it up was we wanted to set ourselves apart from the other big event held here in Victoria every year is the Great Canadian Beer Festival, which is held in September. Over 2 days, and it's one of those big outdoor festivals where thousands of people come and you have, you know, 100 breweries on hand and that sort of thing, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's great. I mean, I love going to GCBF every fall, but we didn't want to duplicate that, and we also, you know, chose a time of year, March, when the weather isn't usually the greatest for doing something like that anyway. So what we've focused on is trying to have really unique, a whole range of events spread out over a whole week, in fact 9 days, that allow anyone who has an interest in beer, from a total novice who's brand new to it and just wants to kind of discover it, to someone who, you know, is a seasoned veteran, so to speak, has, you know, knows everything, thinks they know everything about it, and maybe has tasted every beer, you know, thinks they may have tasted every beer ever produced, kind of thing. So we have that range, and we choose really exciting and dynamic venues to host our events in, like the Victoria Public Market here and the Drake and Market Square. And then also a lot of our events have a real strong food component. So we have a beer and cheese night. We have a beer and gourmet pizza night. This year we're adding a fish and seafood themed event. So, yeah, so basically the variety and the combination of venue and food and beer, I think, is what sets us apart.
That's awesome. Thank you so much, Joe. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Sounds good. Thanks very much.
Yeah, thank you. Take care.
All right, you too.
Thank you, Rohit. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more contributor segments.
Last Band Standing is the AMS event's annual band competition. The winner gets an opener spot at the AMS Black Party, a live performance music video, and more. It's all on right now, so head on over to ams.ubc.ca to vote for the winner until March 8th, and then come out to see the finale. The show is on March 10th at the Pit, with doors at 8 p.m. Tickets are $5 in advance. All proceeds go to Music Heals. Check out AMS Events on Facebook for more info. UBC Mental Health Awareness Club is hosting the annual Defeat Depression Run at UBC, with proceeds going towards club and community mental health support and services. Come out on March 12th to participate in the 5-kilometer run or walk. There will be prizes for top fundraiser. For more information or to register online and start pledging, visit the UBC Mental Health Awareness Club on Facebook and learn how you can make a difference in your community.
Welcome back to News 101. You are listening to us live on CITR 101.9 or online at citr.ca. Broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
Now we have News 101 correspondent Kelly Rabin's report on BC Liberals' move to raise the rates on people with disabilities and the implementation of a $52 monthly bus pass.
A rally was taking place on noon Wednesday, March 2nd, to stop the BC Liberal government for adding the bus pass rate to a $52 monthly rate. Pat Donner has a daughter, Karen, who takes public transit on a regular basis.
It affects me very much. I use my every day.
How frequently do you ride on public transit with your bus pass?
Very often.
Very often?
Every day.
Pat worries that without the bus pass, Karen won't be able to do some of the activities throughout Vancouver.
They go out in the community all day, every day, Monday to Friday. Well, that's
for spectrum.
Pass is, yeah, that pass is not going to last the whole month. You know how she's supposed to pay for it? She's already living on the low poverty level with the money that they give us.
Pat and Karen are the ones who did show up on Commercial Broadway Station in Vancouver and did sign the petition to the government asking to leave the pass alone and to let everyone on disabilities to raise the PWD benefits that will no longer to be able to purchase for the $45 yearly fee. Ernie Batts, the executive director for Spectrum Society for Community Living, explains how the pass will affect with disabilities.
People who have the transportation allowance were getting $66 a month. That is gone as well, and so now they'll only get an $11 increase. We think disability benefits should be $1,200 a month at least. In Alberta, they're $1,500 a month. Mm-hmm.
Ernie says many disability people need those passes to explore the community and to do working incomes that are capable to take the bus on their own. This event took place in New Westminster, Vancouver, and Victoria. Kelly Rayburn, News 101, Vancouver.
Thank you, Kelly. To finish off this episode, we have Emily Blake's interview with Juliet O'Brien on the Paula Butler Report, GSS Sexual Assault Report, and Impending Sexual Assault Policy at UBC.
Juliet O'Brien is a faculty member in the Department of French, Hispanic, and Italian Studies at UBC. She was one of the faculty presenters at the Sexual Assault Discourse and Dialogue Conference on February 15th. She has also been vocal on social media, dissecting news about UBC. I spoke with her about the executive summary of Paula Butler's report, the UBC GSS report, and speaking out as an untenured faculty member.
Okay, to start off, last week a lot of news broke at UBC, including the executive summary of the Paula Butler report, and you've really dissected this report on Twitter. If you could tell me about your reaction to it.
Well, I do languagey type work, so I'll always have several different reactions going on simultaneously. But my main first reaction was actually a positive one. I thought that releasing any kind of statement at all was a good sign that this was being taken seriously, whatever the intentions behind that, whether it was because somebody actually cared about the human beings concerned and cared about the future of changing procedures, or whether they just wanted to pay lip service to an idea. I have no idea. I'm not inside these people's heads. I would like optimistically to think that certain individuals in charge of the university have been thinking seriously about the university and decisions and responsibility, and that they might be changing the way they do things. That would be really good. And yes, a lot of the comments I'd been making had been dissecting things in tedious linguistic philological ways, because that's the kind of research work I do as a medievalist, as a philologist. And it's the kind of work I do when I'm teaching, when I'm working with students on language and literature. And it's what we're teaching people to do as a transferable skill outside narrow courses at UBC, as useful life skills and whatever else they're doing outside. This is analysis, it's critical skills, and it's the kind of questioning that makes you a better citizen. So for example, in that piece when I was looking at how pronouns had been used, this is the kind of exercise that I would do with students in beginner's French. All you're doing is looking at pronouns and saying, who does this we refer to? Anybody could do this, but it's quite revealing when you see how that's changing just in one text and how it's changing outside as well. And I would say for future reference, we've seen this in a few other texts coming out this week, but that would be something to look at really closely in any communications we have coming out from UBC. When you see that word we, who exactly is it? What I'd really like to see is if that we becomes a truly inclusive one. That's we, the university higher authorities, that's we, the university as a whole, and that's a we that's had input from faculty and students and staff and alumni and all their representatives.
So you did note in your Twitter response that there was no mention of the women involved or of specific bureaucrats involved.
Yeah, I did. I was, I'm not quite sure what the word is, offended, angry, upset that the individual people who'd been involved were not named, especially considering that these individuals had, while they were already in damaged state, they'd had the guts to come forward and name themselves and do this publicly with news authorities. They didn't have to do this. They could have hidden. And as a victim, it's much more usual to hide, and it might be expected to hide. And I was offended by this. I can understand from an institutional point of view why you might not want to mention names, partly because you're trying to write a short text, although how much space does it take you to add a few names in it? That's only a few lines. And it's recognising people as individuals. I can understand why you might not want to name individuals within the UBC administration, because it's possible, we don't know anything that's going on, which is part of the problem. It's possible that there are already wheels turning towards dealing with individuals who are responsible. But this is part of the whole problem, that it's dehumanising UBC. It's dehumanising individuals who've been hurt by a process, and it's also dehumanising individuals within this, what's perceived by so many people as an administrative machine. We have lots of people who work in administration UBC who are good, who are lovely people, who are individual human beings. Administrators in my department, for example, with whom we talk all the time. They are people, and within my department, we treat each other as people, which is good. But elsewhere, we have the sense of the administration, this amorphous, faceless beast. It's not even a beast. You're not even sure how animate it is. And there's no sense of responsibility. And this is one of the problems with transparency and perceived transparency at UBC, that there's no individual responsibility for decisions, good or bad.
So as I mentioned, you've been quite vocal on social media about issues going on campus. But I think for a lot of, especially untenured professors and students, there can be a lot of fear about speaking out. Is that a problem for you, or why is it important for you to talk about these issues publicly?
That's a very good question. So I had spoken to other people about this because I am not tenured, and I had colleagues who had worried that this might be an issue. I'm well aware of my legal rights here. I did start out in life as a law student a long time ago. We have protection both within UBC under the Faculty Association and in BC and in Canada for free speech. I've been very careful not to say anything that would be libelous, partly also because that would be unreasonable. I'm only criticising what is available as public information, and I hope what I'm doing is criticism in the correct full sense of the word, positive as well as negative. UBC does many good things too, and I think it's part of the responsibility of any faculty, whether they're tenured or not, that they should feel free to comment on all sorts of things. That commentary can be good as well. Yes, I've been doing this for years in several countries now where I've ever been. I'm quite happy talking about stuff. I've not had any trouble in my own department, quite the contrary. But this is something that's going to be different from department to department within the university, and depending on these very localised subcultures. French, Hispanic and Italian studies has been absolutely fine here. In fact, we talk about all sorts of things all the time, which is great. The colleagues I really feel for are in certain other departments where that is very much not the case, not even for tenured faculty. There are tenured faculty who are scared to say anything about anything, and where the sense is you should keep your nose to the grindstone and just do the work that you're paid for and nothing else, which is feeding into this whole dehumanising nastiness that we want to get out of.
So a number of faculty wrote an op-ed in the Vancouver Sun. It was the same faculty who organized the Sexual Assault Discourse and Dialogue Conference, yeah, about how faculty are starting to wake up and how it's really important that faculty are ones with power to speak out about these issues. Would you agree with that?
Basically, yes. That we have the power to speak out about these issues. Actually, anybody does. What I'd love to see is more op-eds and more people writing, more people speaking publicly about everything, not just faculty. Graduate students, undergraduate staff, alumni. We've seen some other op-eds along the way as well, but we're all part of the UBC community. So I'd actually like to see more, first of all, more co-authored pieces, more multiple voice pieces, and more voices from all over the place, not just faculty. This isn't just a faculty issue. This is everybody, and especially when we're looking at going back to the several events we've had over the last year, and going back especially to the sexual assault cases. This isn't a faculty problem. It's a general human problem, and it's a problem of people accepting that as human beings, they've got a duty of care to each other that goes beyond mere compliance. If you want a really bad example of compliance, something on which I hadn't commented because it would have involved far too many four-letter words, but we had a rather interesting case a year or two back, it feels like forever, on the faculty side, where we had to do a bullying and harassment online survey course thing, at the end of which you got a certificate which declared that you had done your bullying and harassment training, which was labelled as bullying and harassment training rather than anti-bullying and harassment. This was part of UBC compliance with WorkSafe BC, and while it's a good idea that everyone should have done some training on exactly what bullying and harassment are, because some of the situations might be slightly alien, it was, in my view, rather badly handled and could have been done better and could have been done as an exercise in actually learning about something and understanding it properly rather than just box-ticking. And my one big fear about the sexual harassment and assault situation is that we really don't want to end up with another box-ticking policy and procedure of someone saying, yes, we've done what we have to do by the letter of the law. That's showing a complete misunderstanding of what's involved and the fact that these are people who have been hurt and that we want to try and prevent people being hurt in the same way again or reduce the harm caused.
What would you like to see in the sexual assault policy going forward?
One of the things I'd like to see, actually, is for the document produced by the Graduate Student Society to be read more carefully and read attentively, because there are some excellent recommendations in there. That's a very good document. And also to bring in all the material that was discussed at the two-day seminar workshop event last week, and to follow up on the recommendations of the keynote speaker, and to look at this quite seriously. And regard this as an opportunity for UBC to move forwards and become a different kind of university. It's a pivotal historical moment for an institution. It doesn't happen very often, where they have the potential to change and to move in a completely different direction but which will mark them as being way ahead of the rest and the people who are setting a new model for other universities on how to be. But look out for that we. I think that use of we in that piece was very interesting, because that we has great potential for being an inclusive we.
The story also broke about how some GSS executives attempted to sort of bury their report. What was your takeaway from that?
Yes, that was peculiar. That was very peculiar. So there again, I wondered, putting myself into the shoes of the president of the GSS, he apologised, which is a good thing to see. I mean, that's a fairly easy and natural and good first reaction to see I've done something wrong. My worry was that some pressure might have been put on him and on others on the GSS not to publish this